Going to go ahead and convene the meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. I'd like to welcome those in the audience as well as those on the phone, and we'll take a second in a minute to introduce our phone membership. As a task force, this effort is done amidst a whole lot of other work that's occurring at the same time, and so many of our members have had to take the call from their offices and amidst other duties. So we're fortunate that we have the technology to be able to carry on this meeting virtually. So again, we thank you. So I'll introduce, we'll have introductions of the those of us here, very brief introductions of those of us here at the podium, and then we'll go to the phone. So I'm Rick Kincaid, a family physician from Eugene, serve as the co-chair of this committee. So,
Bob. Yeah, I'm Bob Gluckman. I'm an internist. I'm the chief medical officer for Providence Health Plans.
And I am Shannon Newell. I'm with Committee Services, and I'm filling in for Sandy Teeley Circa today.
Very good. Thank you. I would take a moment to ask those on the phone to introduce themselves.
Senator Knopf.
Senator.
Lori Monis Anderson.
Senator. Thank
Ruth
you.
Ruth Salmon.
Thank you, Ruth.
Robin Henderson.
Thank you, Robin.
Mary Grant, co-chair of the task force.
Very good. Thank you, Mary. Any other members on the phone? And we have one additional member just arriving. Running, actually.
Janine Smith, Chief Medical Officer of the Oregon Health Authority.
We wanted to make sure she was oriented to time and place this morning.
I flew in from Princeton, New Jersey last night, so I'm not sure.
So
my phone
oriented.
Says it's 9 o'clock
9
or
o'clock.
11 o'clock or something.
Right. Phone is supposed to change over when you move across time zones.
It
so
is.
You might have to check that. Very good. Well, we thank those on the phone. We do have a couple of members that were not able to attend today, and John Prassis was not able to join us today. Dr. Gluckman will hopefully add a few comments related to some of the concepts and ideas that John wanted to bring across, and then if we have opportunity in subsequent meetings, we'll have some thoughts come from John. Cora Lee was not able to join us this morning. She's got some very significant family health issues that are occurring at this time that have prevented her from being there. She has unfortunately not been able to attend. She sends her regrets. However, we will have Elizabeth Remley with us this morning from the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and so she will help and provide any answering to questions during our first topic item. So we appreciate her attendance today. As far as public comment, I believe at this time we do not have any specific public comment. At least that was signed in. We have one other additional member that just joined us.
I was in the wrong room.
Who was having a meeting in a different room?
Yes.
If you could please introduce yourself.
Representative Julie Parrish.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to begin to proceed with our first item on the agenda. That is, again, to have the perspective of the physician assistant. Again, there's a small number of behavioral health physician assistants that are part of the practices within the state of Oregon at this time, as well as a large cadre of primary care physician assistants that serve the people of this state. So we wanted to make sure that we had a little bit of time for perspective from that. So the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants has submitted a letter in a response to our request for their participation, and that was sent by Cora Lee Koenig, who is the president-elect of the society. So is Ms. Remley present? Okay. Apparently, she is not. For those that have had a chance to review the letter was sent out again, advocating for their the role and position of the physician assistant. As many aware, physician assistants are under direct supervision of a physician practice. They do not operate independently in this environment, but there are 10 currently practicing physician assistants in the psychiatric specialty, and those, again, are primarily used in a variety of specialty practices to provide direct care. And again, they go through a significant amount of training specific to, particularly on the behavioral health side, in order to provide those sorts of service as well as their general education. And so, again, it was pointed out the importance of this part of the workforce. Again, this is a relatively new part of the workforce as it relates to care, primary care and behavioral health. So we'll go ahead and accept that letter from Cora Lee. Any comment from the group that's had a chance to review that? Any comments from the phone? Okay, very well. Well, thank you. So we're going to proceed with the next item on the agenda, and that is, in fact, to begin to try to understand some of the perspective of the both really the consumer, and that represents certainly business, as a large portion of our businesses support healthcare by providing insurance for Oregonians, and as well as the insurer perspective itself. To do that today, we'll have Dr. Bob Gluckman with Providence Health Plans, and then Mylia Christensen from QCorp has been kind enough to come and talk about some of the issues related to payment reform throughout the country and certainly within the state. So we'll have those two presentations, and we'll begin with Dr. Gluckman.
Okay.
I've got you down here, but the PowerPoint will be loaded. So if you want to come sit down here.
Oh, okay.
So hopefully those on the phone have access to Dr. Gluckman's PowerPoint.
All right, thanks very much. Can people hear me okay? All right, appreciate being here today. I think that Rick at the beginning of the meeting mentioned that John Prassas wasn't able to attend. And so I'm going to try to make some points that he and I had talked about. My original comments were really designed to kind of create some awareness of when we think about when this when this legislation was passed, the idea of having payment equity between nurse practitioners and physicians. I thought it was important to try to create some transparency around what are the patient populations that the that family medicine physicians, internists, and nurse practitioners actually take care of, because the E&M coding alone doesn't necessarily reflect the care that goes on into managing populations, and I thought it was important to create some of that transparency around that. John was going to try to shed some light around issues about payment rates in Oregon as compared to some national averages. So, you know, I'm going to try to fill in. I don't have hard data or slides that to present for that. So I'll just kind of go forward with what I have. So this first slide I have is basically Providence Health Plan trends over the previous 13 years as to where the premium goes. So I think that this would be useful for the committee to be aware of. So, you know, on the left side of the graph is where is the distribution of premium from 2000 on, and 2013 is where we were at the end of last year. This yellow line, which has the sharpest rate of growth, is for facility fees. So facility fees include hospitals, but it also includes outpatient ambulatory surgery centers that are not necessarily owned by hospitals. But facility fees is where the highest percentage of the premium goes, and also where you can see the rate of growth is increasing. So new technology, hospital-based treatments that are expensive, all go into that bucket. I would just kind of mention that, you know, the proliferation of ambulatory ASCs is also a factor here. And I think we should just also be aware that the cost of delivering the care is also accelerating. It's not just that this is padding profit for any particular area. This magenta area, those are specialist fees. So those are professional fees for specialist physicians. That's where the next biggest bucket of money is. So you can see in the premium growth, there's been a little stabilization in the last year, but the rate of growth also, as opposed to other services, is higher. This purple line with the X through it, those are our health plan administrative costs. The health plan administrative costs last year were about 8.6% of premium overall for all lines of business, and commercial profit margins for us is in our areas where we bear the risk, fully insured business is less than 1%. What you'll see is that there is a little bit of a bump here in the last couple of years where administrative costs have gone up a little bit. I want to kind of say that the kinds of things that go in there, for example, are the taxes that insurers now have to pay to help fund the subsidies that go on the exchange. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just where the bucket is on the money. You know, so to recognize that in order to not have, people who have pre-existing conditions have access to affordable coverage, the money has to come from somewhere. That's one of those areas, and it's bundled into administrative costs. I didn't want people to be thinking that the administrative costs of running a plan are necessarily running amok. There are other factors that are related to implementation of the Affordable Care Act that do go into here, things like running the exchange. And there are times that there are legislative mandates that come forth at the state level that also increase costs. So as an example, I would just say that when we're paying hospitals as and mandated to pay like Medicare, that requires us to purchase software, which costs $250,000. So all those things kind of add up. This blue line that's in here, those are the proportion of premium that goes to primary care physicians. That's been increasing at a kind of a steady pace, but I would kind of say not quite as fast as some of these areas, but I would say that in 2013, the primary care reimbursement overall increased around 10%. And one thing I think is important for the group to be aware of is that for Providence, I can't speak for other carriers, but I don't think there's major differences, is my gut feeling, is that 10% of the premium in a commercially insured population goes to primary care. In Medicare, it was last year it was 7.7%. In Medicaid, it was a little over 12%. In this week's Journal of the American Medical Association, there's an editorial from the Brookings Institute, and they quote the fact that nationally about 5% of premium goes to primary care. So in Oregon, we are paying a much higher percentage of the premium and maybe the highest in the country. And I don't know what necessarily the right number is. I think it's uncommon for, Janine is, so those not in the room had a question about why I would say that. I don't think it's very common that 10% of a commercial premium goes to pay for primary care services across the country. So Rhode Island, for example, passed some sort of a mandate a few years back, and that number is still less than what we're currently paying. So that doesn't mean that the allocation of services is correct. It's just that relative to the rest of the country, we do have more premium going to primary care than other parts of the country. And then this other one that's a little harder to see, it's this blue line with the X's here that you're starting to see some increase. Those are our pharmacy costs. So we have very high generic use rates. Our generic use rates in the commercial marketplace are close to 89%. But as new drugs come on the market, so these would be things like self-administered chemotherapy drugs, that come on the market that are pretty expensive. I think everybody in the room is probably, anxiously awaiting what's going to happen this year with the hepatitis C drugs, which is going to run into millions of dollars and is going to create budgetary challenges for the state, but also for commercial carriers and for the employers and individuals as well. And so that number is, right around here. You can see that there's been some acceleration in the last year, which is primarily related to some of these new, very expensive drugs. So, you know, John was going to talk a little bit about, you know, some of these other concerns. So these are some of my random thoughts that I put together yesterday when I knew John couldn't be here.
Well, can I ask a question?
Sure.
This is Rick. I was just wondering, when you look at the behavioral health cost to a health plan, is that varied within your specialty cost?
So that would be separate from here on this, because we, you know, as you know, Providence has a carve-out with Optum. So if I had to, I can look it up, and I'll do that because I can give you a number pretty quickly as to the exact percentage in a commercial product. But it'll take me like a minute to do that, so I could probably multitask and go on and get back to your question.
Okay.
If
thank
you'll,
you
challenge me to think, can I really multitask? But people tell me I do that too much as it is. So this next slide that I have here, just to kind of give you some sense, is, you know, something that is important to recognize is that there is a cost shift that goes on for commercial carriers as a result of relatively low rates for Medicaid. Now, I don't know what's going to happen in the next year, because as you've probably seen, the level of the rates for the uninsured have gone down, and so hospitals are getting some relief, but they're also taking care of a lot of Medicaid patients where those costs really are not recovered through the revenues that are generated. So if different institutions have variability in how much Medicaid they care for in their community, then that's going to affect their commercial rates. So if I give an example of a community that I'm aware of in Central Oregon that whose commercial payer rates are down below 30%, you know, and then they have to somehow shift some of the cost of the Medicaid, and Medicare rates are also probably getting closer below their cost for delivering the care, then the commercial rates are going to be up higher. If there's variation between different health systems and how much Medicaid burden they have or how they're reimbursed by the state for Medicaid services, that's going to affect their commercial rates, because at the end of the day, they've got to cover their infrastructure, pay their, you know, margins and the like. And there are some, you know, systems that may have variation in how much of the cost shift has to be shifted to the commercial population. So that's a concern, you know, that we have, because it does affect our commercial rates. I think that provider consolidation is an issue. So I know John was going to talk about this in a little bit more detail, because Oregon pays very high unit costs as compared to the rest of the country for services. Now, that market consolidation is not limited to hospitals. You know, this is, you know, if we are looking at physician services, there is essentially one cancer group in Eugene, and one cancer group in Medford, and one cancer group in Salem. I don't want to pick on just cancer, because there's one GI group in those areas, and there's dominant orthopedic groups. And so I think this issue of provider consolidation also affects rates, and there is, I think, high unit costs in Oregon compared to other parts of the country, so that's a concern. So, Rick, to get back to your question to me, the mental health and chemical dependency budget roughly is about 3% of premium.
Okay.
It did go up about 10% in our costs in the last year. And those numbers, I'm only describing those numbers for our large and small group fully insured business. So when I said that, because that's the table, I can pick it up. I don't think it's a lot different from one to the other. So getting back to the slide set, I do think a concern for payers are the rising administrative burdens, and to be sure that when we have mandates that we're mandating high-value care and not putting mandates in for low-value care. So I mentioned some of the issues about administrative burden that are coming on as part of the Affordable Care Act, and you know, I think that when you're talking about expanding care, which is, you know, and creating access for a large segment of the population, some of that's to be expected. It's just that people should be aware that, you know, there's no escape from some of those things. But to be aware as the legislators are considering other things, that these mandates do add cost. I have some concern about about provider oversupply for some services and what does that do to utilization. So I think that there are 9 open heart centers in Portland. 9. I don't know that we need 9. You know, but so when you have smaller volumes, you lose some of the efficiency. But I also just said 2 bullets earlier that I was concerned about provider consolidation and what that does to unit cost. So, you know, it's the yin and the yang. It's just that if you have oversupply, you may get more services delivered than is actually required for the population. Cost of new treatments is a concern. I mentioned hepatitis C, you know, some of the new chemotherapy drugs, you know, for small differences in life expectancy, large differences in cost, you know, marginally beneficial technology, example might be the explosion of the use of robot-assisted surgery in areas where the outcomes are not significantly better, but everybody's got to have their robot. And then lastly, you know, and a big one, is the variation in delivery of services both on the cost and the quality side, because that's where there is the potential for significant opportunity. This next slide is a story that I know, you know, Janine has seen. Oh, yes, Rick.
Bob, you just asked a question. Have you seen any shift in sort of the percentage of cost toward preventative care or wellness as you've gone forward over the last few years? Has your company been able to shift cost into those areas? Yeah.
So, as I mentioned earlier, the cost for primary care services has increased at a double-digit rate, whereas our overall costs, you know, depending on the line of business, is in the very low single digits. So if I use the example for PEB and our claims allowed, and all these numbers that I'm really talking about are claims allowed, so it's not necessarily what the member pays, because if there's changes in benefit structure, that may affect what the patient actually pays or what happens to the premium. But from my perspective, what we really want to do is be looking at what's not really looking at how we shift more cost to somebody else, is how are we controlling the cost of the services that are being delivered to patients. So so what I could say is for you know, most of our, so for PEB, the average increase in claims allowed over a 4-year period is about 1.5%. Last year there was a double-digit increase for primary care services. A good portion of that is for preventive services, and we've seen similar things, I'd say. Now, I think that it's early to say where is there immediate savings generated. And I do think that there are fundamental differences in the commercial population and in the Medicaid population as to what the challenges are to control cost and improve quality. Because in the Medicaid population, you're having patients who traditionally haven't had access to services, a higher incidence of coexisting behavioral health issues, people who are low socioeconomic determinant, you know, I mean, who are challenged by socioeconomic determinants of health and low health literacy, behavioral health issues. And so those are factors that occur in the commercial population, but more so in the Medicaid population. In the commercial population, I think that what I'm going to show you next is some of the variation around care you know, where maybe there's a provision of services that aren't medically necessary or are marginal in benefit, or where we're learning new things and it can implement new, less expensive ways of delivering care. And I think that as many authors have talked about in the commercial population, the United States is challenged by price, and price is a big factor. So yes, there's an increase in preventive services. As a percentage of the total premium, I think it's fairly modest. Mm-hmm. So this is a story from PEB I know Janine has seen, but I don't know if the other people on the phone or other state representatives, senators, have had the opportunity to see before. But I think it's a nice illustration of what we can do when we show some, create some transparency on variation in the provision of services and looking at what can happen. So each one of these bars, these colored bars, is a community where a PEB member lives. Okay, so the unit of analysis here is where the member lives, not where they got the services, because what we wouldn't have wanted to happen if somebody came from a rural area and had their services done in Portland, that service was attributed to Portland, because it's really, they may have been referred appropriately. So on the left is the rate of cardiac cath per 1,000. In the middle, it's the insertion of a cardiac stent per 10,000 patients. On the right, it's bypass surgery. And this is the initial data that we looked at. I think people know we assumed the responsibility for administering a good portion of the state employee health benefits in January 2010. And so this was the analysis from the first 7 quarters, and you can see that there's a community in green there that performs services at a much higher rate, and we weren't able to explain that from the age, sex, demographics in the community. So in partnership with our delivery system, we were able to develop some strategies to think about how can we create some better transparency. And there's a data set through the American College of Cardiology that all hospitals that perform invasive cardiac procedures in the state participate in, which can give us some real granular clinical data, because what insurers commonly have is claims data. But what you need to have to drive changes in care is marry the claims data to the clinical data. So each one of these bars here is a hospital. The color in blue here are the patients who were having a heart attack when they presented to the institution. The color in purple here are patients who have unstable angina, so they're patients who are, you know, have high risk for having a heart attack in the immediate future. And in those patients, a stent is the standard of care and prevents death and it prevents recurrent heart attacks. The green bar are patients who have stable angina. So these are patients who have chest pain, but where their medical literature would show that the ability to reduce mortality or reduce myocardial infarction is not really impacted by an intervention. The effectiveness of medical therapy for those two things is equal. However, stents for patients who cannot have adequate control of their chest pain do offer benefit of better control of chest pain. So the role of treating the patients in green are patients to get relief of chest pain, but the value would be patients who can't otherwise get adequate relief with medication alone. And the red bar here are patients who had symptoms that were unlikely to be angina. And these would be things like people who had angiography for a heart valve, and they need that, you know, as part of their new onset heart failure. These are standard of care where an angiogram would be appropriate. And I would also just mention, this is all payer data. So this is all institutional data. It's their registry, so it includes Medicare, it includes Medicaid and the like. But what you can see is that this community, E, had the smallest percentage of patients who were having a heart attack getting a stent, the highest percentage of patients who were stable getting a stent. And the hospital in community E, is the same community that had the highest rate of services that were provided to the community. So we shared this information and had a statewide meeting and did not offer any payment changes as a result of this. So payment methodology changes, you know, are sometimes necessary to create the environment that people can change care. But one thing we shouldn't be doing is paying for, and this is a quote that I'm stealing from Helen Darling from the National Business Coalition on Health or whatever, we shouldn't be paying for things that never should have been done in the first place. And I think we have to think about that when we start to think about payment reform. So these are the results that people have seen. That this intervention occurred right around here, and you can see that there's a dramatic reduction in the use of cardiac caths, and it followed through for stents and everything else just by sharing information about appropriateness. And so I wanted to illustrate that because I think one thing that we have to be concerned about is how can we create more transparency around variation in care, and there's an opportunity for cost savings there. Now, and this is our differences that we've seen in improvement in quality since we've tried to create some of this transparency around that. So these are quality profiles. Providence gives providers feedback if they have to have 50 patients or more with us, and they get a quarterly report on a quality score that's made up of about 10 different quality metrics. The curve on the left is the baseline rates, quality scores in 2005, and what you can see is that they've increased significantly when this blue line is in 2010. There's a significant increase in the mean of the quality score and a reduction in the variation. And you can see this improvement in 2013 is the green line. We've had continued improvement on these folks here where their quality scores have gone up. And we've introduced into new communities since 2005. So we have more patients that are included here in rural Oregon, in
in Washington State, where they've not had the several years of quality reporting. So there's still opportunity here to move people along farther, but I think that there is still variation in quality that also needs to be addressed.
I'm sorry, can you just clarify the actual measurement of quality? You said patient, was this a patient survey data, or is this a combination of multiple quality measures?
Right. So it's a summary score of multiple quality measures. So to give you examples of the things that are in those measures, they would be things like emergency room use and admissions for ambulatory sensitive respiratory conditions, admission rates for heart failure, the use of imaging services in patients who present for back pain within 6 weeks of their presentation for back pain, the prescription of antibiotics within 3 days of a visit for an upper respiratory tract infection, measurement rates of mammography, rates of hemoglobin A1C measurement in diabetics, measurements of lipids in patients who have risks, emergency room use during weekdays, and member retention. So, so if people leave a panel, that was also a part of our proxy measure that we can take from administrative data to look at patient satisfaction. Administering patient satisfaction at the granular provider level would not be very useful for a plan level because of sample size issues. So, and those are the metrics off the top of my head, but I think those are the right ones.
Yeah, nicely done. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, so now I'm going to move into the areas of the material that I had prepared for this session, and I'll try to walk people through this, and I think that there will be some questions here. So this first slide basically looks at the our measured risk adjustments for patients cared by different PCP provider types, and this is restricted to our commercial population. And one of the things I really tried to do here was to recognize that there's going to be some variation based on the type of setting people practice in. So one thing I didn't put on the slide is I wanted to separate out our independent nurse practitioners that practice in rural areas. Okay, we only have 1,000 patients that are cared for in that environment, so the validity of that risk score is questionable. But that number is 1.54. Just to give you some grounding as to what that was. But there's only 1,000 patients of ours cared for in that model. So this PCP group, so these would be, primary care groups. These would be, usually going to be small to medium-sized groups. They don't have any specialists employed by the group. And they could be groups of varying sizes. They could be, independent to, could be a 20 or 30 person group even, but most of them are going to be small to medium sized practices. The blue bar is family medicine. Their risk score is this 1.44. So the nurse practitioners in this PCP group care for a 5% less acute patient population than the family physicians, but the differences between internal medicine are substantial. So, this 23, it's almost a 20% difference on a risk score, which is actually really huge. To have a 20% difference in risk score. This multi-specialty group, this is a little harder to parse out. So these are going to be tend to be large entities that employ both specialists and primary care physicians. So I'm able to generate the family physician numbers and the internal medicine numbers. What I would point out on this nurse practitioner number is they would include nurse practitioners that are embedded in specialist practices. So if a cardiology practice is embedded in this and they have nurse practitioners working in the cardiology practice, they're going to be embedded because we can't tell from our claims data at the multi-specialty group level who is a primary care nurse practitioner versus who is a cardiology nurse practitioner. So that probably accounts for why the nurse practitioner risk profiles are a little higher, but we can tell who's practicing general internal medicine versus another specialty. And again, you can see this very substantial difference between internal medicine and primary care. And then I also pulled and nurse practitioners and family physicians. And then I also pulled our Providence Medical Group data because I had access to that. That's pretty clean. And again, you can see there is a 5-6% difference between family medicine and nurse practitioners. But again, here this would be more than 25% difference between internal medicine and and nurse practitioners. So not all primary care is alike. When you're paying for an E&M service, which is now mandated to be the same, the between-visit care, which is supposed to be embedded in the code, may or may not adequately reimburse for the differences in the care that's required to care for people in a non-face-to-face setting. And I think that that's very important going forward if we're going to talk about reimbursement reform. So I looked at the billing patterns and I chose to display where most of the visits are, which is established E&M visits. So, you know, not too many people bill level 2 visits. Most people are billing level 3 and 4 visits. Not too many people bill level 5 visits. The blue bar is family medicine. The red bar is internal medicine. The green bar is our nurse practitioners. So what you can see is for a level 4 visit, which is your standard office visit for people who have multiple chronic conditions or who have an acute exacerbation of a problem, that there's not a lot of difference in the billing rates between family medicine and nurse practitioners, and there is a absolute difference of about 6% of the visits more coded in this way for internal medicine. But if I look at the revenue associated with that over the all the office visits, you know, it's going to maybe be a 5% bump in revenue, you know, and to deal with the care of a patient who's much more acute. So I illustrate this because I think that the idea that if you adjust E&M fee-for-service codes and that's somehow going to create the revenue match to the needs of the patient populations who are chronically ill, that's an error. If I looked at what I asked my analyst to do is pull the top 10 diagnostic codes that were attached to a visit. You know, in retrospect, I might have wanted to have done this a little differently, but that's what I have. So it basically does show you that for that 2.8% of the internist visits for diabetes compared to 2.1% for nurse practitioner. So again, it's about a 25% difference, which would kind of correlate with some of the acuity issues. But for frequency of office visits related to an upper respiratory tract infection, a cough or a pharyngitis, you know, for nurse practitioners, that's 7.5% of their visits. It's 3.9% for family medicine, 3.2%. And so one of the things that the legislation has done when we're talking about mandating code changes is we're paying higher rates for frequency of office visits related to URI, while we're also paying for some higher rates for diabetes. But I think that difference to understand that the goal of should not be, from a payer perspective, to pay more for low acuity care. We need to be devoting more resources for patients who have chronic needs and who are more expensive to take care for, where the work is more intense. And so going forward, that's an area where I have some concern about the impact on the legislation.
So, Bob, this is Janine. But don't you get that by the complexity code? So charging a 3, you wouldn't charge right. a 4 for a cold.
Correct. So what I showed you was it was a 6% absolute difference in the frequency of the code visit. So that might impact overall, if I looked at the revenue generated from the E&M codes, for it's insufficient to make up for the differences in complexity. And as you know, Janine, the E&M coding system is fraught with all sorts of difficulty. So we need something that's different, that recognizes that higher complexity care needs to be reimbursed differently. So whether that's a combination of risk-adjusted case management fees, whether we're talking about global budgets, you know, that are risk-adjusted. So what I think this says to me is that the E&M coding system and equating the two does mean that we probably devoted more resources to lower acuity care. And, you know, we will see as this is instituted in the next year when we look at cost of care in certain areas, you know, what actually is the impact. But I mention this because there are pressures that are appropriate to stabilize premium. And so for state employees, you have a 3.4% mandate. And we're looking at could easily be a 3% increase this year just from the hepatitis C drugs. Yeah. And other new things that come up down the pike. And then if we're also, if we can promote a culture of wellness and give people access, and if we're preventing emergency room visits, then there's a cost benefit to that. But if we're paying more for lower acuity care, then we will have a greater difficulty meeting that 3.4% target. And I think that those targets need to are things that we should be aspiring to in the commercial marketplace all over. Because, and if we can't reach it, then we're going to have benefit erosion. And as I alluded to earlier, Oregon is a little unique because we're dealing with high unit costs, and there is a fair amount of market consolidation, so unit costs are a factor. So utilization rates are pretty good in Oregon, but commercial premiums are about average, which basically says that that the purchasers, and when I say the purchasers, I'm talking about employers and individuals, are not necessarily getting as much benefit from the low utilization as they should. Because if we're in top low utilization, you know, in the country and high quality, which we're a high quality state, then the costs, you know, could the costs be lower? But they're not. So I, as you know, I'm concerned about cost. We're all concerned about cost. So my premise on this is that the coding differences alone don't make up for the complexity of the patient population.
One other question: what about? I know Providence is paying a case management for patient-centered primary care home. Are these is that factored in? I mean, you're doing it in PEB, and you're doing it in some of your
Yeah, we're doing it in PEB. We are one of the two large commercial carriers participating in CPCI.
CI, right.
And we have some other products. So that would be factored in that first slide that
administrative.
And it was a contributing factor to the double-digit increases in primary care services, which I'm not saying that's a misallocation of resources. I'm just letting you know that the baseline in Oregon is different than it is in other states. So when we try to say what's right for Oregon, we shouldn't be ignoring where we are today, which differs to a degree than other states.
In those communities, Bob, that you are, do participate and provide those additional funds for that case management, do you see utilization pattern changes as far as ER hospitalization, or is it too early to tell?
So I can't say that I've broken down ED utilization rate by practice level. So which practices are getting case management fees versus which are not. What I can say is that we have a long experience with medical home, probably the longest of a private carrier in the state. And as we've expanded medical home, we have seen the cost differentials between medical home and our other products start to erode. Now, that may just be a timing issue of getting people up to speed on what medical home is. But you're also aware that some of the national literature is showing some conflicting issues. So there was a paper published in JAMA this year looking at the Philadelphia market that showed that the large introduction of medical home payments and practices didn't result in any overall differences in cost or quality. What it did show was that if you took a subset of particularly high-risk individuals, it made their care better. So as part of what I kind of commented on earlier is that when we're talking about reimbursement reform, it's going to be very important to be sure that we target higher reimbursement to the most acute. While we still have sufficient reimbursement to provide the wellness services that need to be provided, but those services are less complex, they are less risky, and we're not going to get cost savings. When we will get cost savings, if, and it won't be for years. And so, you know, you have short-term goals and long-term goals, and we ought to be clear on what they are.
And the risk adjustment numbers you gave before were for populations 18 and older?
Those risk adjustment populations would be in our commercial marketplace, so they would include children. I did not show pediatric practices for that reason. I can tell you that the differences between pediatricians and nurse practitioners on our risk profiles was not very high. I should also actually mention that the risk profile for patients that we could attribute to a large urgent care provider of services was, those numbers I showed you were around 1.4 for nurse practitioners, 1.6 to 1.8 for internal medicine. Those numbers were around 0.6. Yeah, and so, you know, very low acuity, you know, services. So it's true that if a that part of the difference in the acuity level for internal medicine as opposed to family medicine and nurse practitioners is related to having an older patient population. But those risk adjusters would include the intensity of services that are provided to pediatric populations that need more intensive services, like in the first, 15 months of life when you're having six visits. So that would be factored in. So the acuity level for a newborn is higher than it would be for a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just important to when you look at that data comparing family medicine, internal medicine, and nurse practitioners, to that age adjustment is significant, as nurse practitioners and family medicine do care for, obviously, lower acuity individuals, those under 18.
Right, and a significant component of that is age and sex, but some of it's also illness burden. And that's where, recognizing what's the complexity, the intensity of services, the amount of between-visit work that needs to be done, managing the, if we're talking about how are we going to have cost containment, as we all know, the top 5% of patients account for 50% of the spend. And so thinking about how we allocate resources is going to be, it's really going to be, necessary to make sure that we provide those services to people that can prevent avoidable, reduce events and improve outcomes for people who have a much higher risk of getting sick.
What about patient assignment in terms of, are they, I guess the only place you really have control of that is PMG group, but do the nurse practitioners get assigned a lower acuity from the beginning, or?
No, it's based on
These are across all those.
It's based on billing.
It's based on administrative claim, data based on the diagnoses that are attached to the claims, along with the age and sex and the spend. So it's also the spend. That's in the risk adjuster. So they're not. The question that you're asking is do we assign a patient based on an attributed methodology or an assigned methodology? So this is mostly a commercial product. So basically, for the folks in the audience, when it's assigned, that means you have a product where a patient has to choose a PCP. So like on our Medicare products, everybody has to choose a PCP. In Medicaid, patients have to choose a PCP. That makes, I will tell you, that makes payment reform easier, because you can design global budgets and you can design, a risk adjuster for a patient population and assign it to a group if you actually know with certainty that that's who they're taking care of. Our attribution methodology is kind of a robust formula that looks at, who's providing the most care over a period of time. And it does include going back to, it can be done by a single visit if they've had no other visits and they can be attributed. So it's true that if somebody's doing a lot of urgent care, they're going to be attributed to have a lower patient population. But
they're probably more likely to see the upper respiratory infection.
That's right.
Than the diabetic.
But we have a bill that would now mandate an equal reimbursement for a level 3 code, regardless of whether you're taking care of diabetes or hypertension or an upper respiratory tract infection. So going forward, because I think the purpose of our task force is to decide what do we need to do going forward. And it would be, it's much easier to design payment innovation around an assigned population than an attributed population, because my dream, I don't know if I want to call that my dream, but would be if I could pay primary care physicians a risk-adjusted fee to care for the population without designating how they provide the services would be great, because then whether they do it by phone, whether they do group visits, whether they do video chats, whether they do email, whether they do face-to-face visits, they could actually match the services to what the patients actually want and need. It's difficult to do that on an attributed basis, where the patient hasn't necessarily designated a care team. So going forward, is there some way to have requirements that people have to designate a care team? There's probably pluses and minuses to that, but it makes payment innovation and creating accountability for cost and quality much easier to implement. I got some mental health data. So I think the transparency, I have Jeff Meyerhoff in the back, who's the National Medical Director for Optum. If there's questions that I can't answer, you can probably answer. I think people know that Optum provides behavioral health services for us, and one of the things that I think we can get from that is a little more data about national practice patterns, and also the opportunity to develop programs that could be a little bit more sophisticated. So the data set for this is looking at utilization and prescribing patterns for physicians and nurse practitioners, Oregon and nationally. It includes over almost a half a million treatment episodes, and the treatment episodes are based on a defined period of time. And the analysis was limited to the almost 10,000 network providers who had at least 10 episodes of care that they were providing for a patient. And this was looking at the Optum's national data for the last year. The pharmacy data does not include Providence's membership because we pay the pharmacy claims. So here's Oregon. Here's the national data. Basically shows that physicians are doing a little more pediatric work than their nurse practitioners, and that our Oregon physicians and national physicians take care of some more women as opposed to men. Most of the patients are commercially insured, but nurse practitioners tend to take care of more patients who are in public programs, Medicare and Medicaid. This is the what I could was able to generate to look at the potential acuity differences from the patient populations. So it would basically look at, you know, how did a patient come into a physician or nurse practitioner practice. So physicians are more likely to get patients who are discharged from a facility. So that's going to be a higher acuity patient population. And then you can see that differences are about, you know, 25 or 30%. And then this looked at readmission rates. And these are relatively, I'll show you on the next slide, the number of providers. So I think in Oregon, they're relatively small numbers. So I think you have to be somewhat cautious about drawing conclusions. But I do think that you can say that there's some acuity difference. And I think you can also say that if people get care, their readmission rates go down. That may be some regression to the mean, but it also may be because now they're getting care. But it does kind of indicate that physicians are more likely to get patients from a hospital setting, so there's going to be some acuity differences. There's not a big difference here in looking at any kind of specific diagnoses that these that the nurse practitioners and the psychiatrists are taking care of, except for maybe a little bit of a difference in substance abuse, a little bit more from a physician standpoint, but I don't think that these are extreme differences here. Adjustment disorder, a little more for nurse practitioners. This is the average number of visits for an episode of care. So, again, I kind of do want to emphasize that the sample size on the Oregon side is relatively small. But what you can see of interest here is that as a proportion of the panel, nurse practitioners make up a higher percentage than they do nationally, where, you know, nationally Optum's dealing with mostly physicians. These are the number of episodes. These were the average number of visits. So physicians saw patients for an episode of care a little bit more than nurse practitioners, but when you case mix adjusted, it gets to be about the same. So the intensity of services offered after case mix adjusted is fairly similar. This looks at non-adherence to medications, and the data here would show that patients that are cared for by nurse practitioners tend to be a little bit more adherent to their treatment regimens than patients that are cared for by physicians. Again, I just caution about drawing conclusions because, as I mentioned before, the patients that physicians getting, there are more patients who are admitted from or discharged from a hospital where the acuity levels may be higher. But I think that this is still, you know, relevant and something that the group should be aware of, and that the there's an opportunity here to improve care. But there isn't the same level of difference that I think I was able to show on the medical side of things. And so those are basically the information I had to present today. Any other questions?
Great. Thank you, Bob. Open it to questions from panel or particularly the phone. I know it's hard to probably follow a lot of this on the phone, but would definitely welcome questions and particularly hopefully, Mary, as you looked at some of that data that Bob presented, if you have comment as well, that would be helpful.
Not a very, you can imagine. This is Lori, and I think the thing that really resonated with me is when the statement was made that we really, when it comes to reimbursement, it will be far easier to look at populations of care rather than who is a nurse practitioner or who is a physician. And probably along with that, it goes acuity levels too, but I guess that's all in the coding. That's the only comment I have.
Robin, any comment, or Senator Knopf?
I'm still suggesting. Thanks.
This is Ruth. I thought it was a pretty clear presentation.
I would agree, Senator Knopf.
Good. Thank you, Dr. Gluckman. Excellent discussion. Again, our attempt at this point is to really try to begin to understand how dollars are expended across the state and certainly across the nation with respect to, are we sort of getting our value out of that? And I think several of the points that Dr. Gluckman brings up will be important in our discussion as we go forward, particularly as we look at the risks of populations and those cared for, making sure they're cared for in the appropriate settings. So thank you. So the next presenter, and what I'd like to do sort of agenda-wise is we'll ask Malia Christensen to come forward for her presentation, and she'll do an introduction of both herself and also QCOR. For those folks that are not aware of what QCOR is and how it started and what its composition and purpose is, I think that will be important, particularly as she presents some of this data. So she will start with that, and then at the completion of that, we'll take a brief recess so that can sort of adjust, and then we'll come back and tackle the last couple of items on the agenda. So. Thank you very much, Malia, for coming this morning, and look forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Kincaid, Co-Chair Grant, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Malia Christensen. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation. Delighted to be with you.
Malia, can you move closer to the telephone microphone? It's really hard to hear you.
It is very difficult to hear her.
That's because you're used to hearing my booming voice.
Yeah. We'll readjust the microphones here.
And I'll try to use my outside voice as well. Is that better? Maybe not.
A little bit. And let's see.
I am right into the microphone, so I don't know if that's helping.
Okay.
Is that an I'll try.
We don't want her to do a self-induced tonsillectomy at this point.
An avoidable medical procedure for sure.
Make sure it's reimbursed properly.
That's true. Depends on the acuity of care.
All right. Very good. Again, thank you very, very much for inviting me to be here this morning. I thought we could start with just a brief overview of the organization, and then I was asked to where Dr. Gluckman sort of got into a lot of great detail about regional experience. I was asked to sort of cast a wider net, sort of doing a little bit of treetop perspective about national payment reform, a little bit about regional payment reform, and then perhaps just leave you with a few thoughts and perspectives as we travel across the state of Oregon, working with individuals who are actually trying to do this very important work. So for those of you who may not be familiar with my organization, our mission is to improve the quality and affordability of healthcare in Oregon, and we do that by leading community collaborations and producing unbiased information. We have been around since 2000. We are a nonprofit organization. We consider ourselves to be a neutral and independent organization trying to facilitate real and meaningful change in Oregon. We also were built on the premise that all the right people should be at the table. So in all of our work, we are committed to the notion that all stakeholders, which include purchasers, providers, consumers, policymakers, business owners, all of those involved in the healthcare system should be at the table together solving problems for the greater community, as opposed to more focused efforts that tend to focus on an organization or a specific set of the population. We have over 150 volunteers who serve on 11 standing committees, and we do quite a bit of work in this area. Just to give you a sense, we are doing work in payment reform, so that's an example of convening community collaboratives where we're trying to get all stakeholders to work together on payment reform. We also have a very strong and rich history in Oregon in the collaborative effort to provide data to the community that's meaningful and actionable in terms of transforming healthcare. So Oregon is unique in this, in that the largest payers in Oregon have contributed the administrative claims data to a collaborative into a claims database that allows us at this point to have 100% of the Medicare data for the state of Oregon, almost 100% of the Medicaid data, and 83% of the commercial population. So we have over 3 million Oregonians who are currently in a database that now has 6 years of information. And we use that now to try to support all of the wonderful activities that are happening in transformation. We are nationally recognized. We are one of 16 of the Aligning Forces for Quality Communities, funded by Robert Wood Johnson, the largest signature effort of this foundation. We have a Good Housekeeping seal of approval for the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which is actually known as a Chartered Value Exchange. We are one of 30 community organizations across the country known as the Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement, all doing similar kind of work but in different geographic locations. And this last year, we were fortunate to be one of the first few organizations recognized by CMS as a qualified entity, which is why we have the data from CMS for fee-for-service Medicare for the first time ever in Oregon. So we're very excited about that. This is just a map of where we are. When Dr. Kincaid asked me to talk a little bit about what's happening in the country, this is a network that represents about 40 to 50% of the population of the United States, so there are a lot of activities that are taking place across the country. This is such a skilled committee that I'm going to try to move fairly quickly, but I think a few just sort of general statements I would make. Everywhere I go, no matter where I am, I think everybody believes that fee-for-service is done, but the problem is how to get from moving away from fee-for-service to all these new models, not only of clinical care transformation, but also how do we actually recreate the payment structure and the building blocks. You would argue perhaps that there are at least 25 or 35 years of payment reform, depending how old one might be, because we've been at this for a long time, right? I mean, I've been at it since the 70s, and there are all kinds of versions I saw in the 70s and the 80s as well. I think there is a fevered, widespread interest in payment reform, no matter where you are, but I think there's very little agreement on the method or the implementation strategies behind it. Also, a lot of pressure to accelerate, but I think one of the things that is missing is a lot of rigorous evaluation for how well a particular attempt is working and how quickly we can share that information across the country, which is a huge challenge, especially for people who are trying to do this work. Again, I know many of you are steeped and seasoned in some of this. I think there are major categories of payment reform, a lot of new language and vocabulary and acronyms that are going around, but at least major themes from afar and near include an attempt to try to bundle payments around episodes of care. And there are many, many regional examples, and I actually apologize because I was sure that Dr. Gluckman in the Regent's presentation would include great examples of work in some of these areas, so I didn't spend a lot of time in my presentation on them. But, you know, the general idea, I think, is to try to isolate specific conditions or specific procedures, basically settle based on data and analysis on a particular price for those services, and then hold accountable those individuals both on quality and in terms of cost, the outcomes, and results. A tremendous amount of activity around a notion called shared savings, again, an idea that's been around for some time, but is the idea that providers and health systems who are participating in that activity could actually not only be responsible for the improvement on quality, but also could take part in the savings if the savings are sufficient to generate formulas that equal $2 back in the pockets of providers and clinicians. I think one of the oldest methodologies is pay for performance. I would say, again, for those of us that have been around for a while, very effective at improving certain kinds of performance and reimbursement incentives that align. I think universally people would say it's not enough, and it hasn't gone far enough, but it's an important element that's been around for a while. Many of you are well steeped in patient-centered medical home activities here in Oregon and across the nation. It is literally impossible, I believe, at this point to track how many of these activities there are in terms of both the types, the components, the elements, and certainly the payment reform that goes along with these activities. And so I'll make some mention of that, but I think the fundamental piece there is they are the building blocks of accountable care organizations. They're the building blocks for Oregon for CCOs. And to Dr. Gluckman's presentation, how primary care is ultimately reimbursed for the future is a critical part of payment reform. And if you listen to different stakeholders in Oregon, depending on which group you're talking to, there's a tremendous amount of debate about, to Dr. Gluckman's point, what's the right amount? What's the amount that covers the care for the initial transformation, as well as the amount that's actually going to pay for the kinds of services that the clinical transformation is required to have, and yet requires a great deal of upfront expenses. I thought I would try to give you just a quick sense, at least of information that we're aware of. How far has payment reform gone so far? The Catalyst for Payment Reform Scorecard for 2013, which was released recently, basically tried to say, how far have we gone yet in trying to establish value-based payments on the commercial side? So this was one organization's attempt. It's filled with caveats and disclaimers, so please note that. But it gives you, I think it was a first attempt. So for fee-for-service with shared savings on the commercial side, about 2% of the overall plans. For bundle payments, about 1.6%. For fee-for-service with some type of pay-for-performance built on top of it, about 1.6 for specific capitation for a condition, about 1.3, and overall shared risk at about 1.2. And again, I think there's a fever out there about it, but I think when you get down to really practical numbers of how far along are we with really large-scale implementations, other than one I'll talk about on the national level for ACOs, I think there's a lot of work going on without a lot of definitive evidence yet about what the outcomes of these activities are. So with that, again, I think probably the largest payment reform experiment happening in concert is one that is being at least initially directed at the federal level, accountable care organizations. Many of you know the Health and Human Services rules for accountable care organizations came out in late 2011. In essence, this encourages doctors, hospitals, and other providers to form networks to coordinate care, to be responsible both for the clinical outcomes and also be eligible for bonuses. There are 33 quality measures that are required by ACOs, and there's a debate about how many of them are there. Every conference I go to, there's a different map that shows this, but I think somewhere in the range of 300 to 400 ACOs, probably in the Medicaid realm, based on the most recent information, hundreds now more developing on the commercial side across the country. I saw a recent statistic from a Becker publication that about 14% of the population in the United States may be receiving care from an ACO at this point, but 52% of the population lives in a geographical region where an ACO is available. As all of you know, there were huge savings that were predicted for ACOs in the original projections for Medicare with a $940 million savings, which is relatively small, less than 1% when you think of overall Medicare spending. So the next slide is just, I'm going to show you two quick things about kind of what do we know. This was a Kaiser Family Foundation publication that talked about what do we know about, you know, sort of the first years of ACO implementation. Of the original rollout of the original model of ACOs, there were 114 shared savings ACOs. 54 had lower spending than projected. Only 29 generated enough savings to keep some of those dollars. In the next version of the Pioneer ACOs, which included a higher risk model for providers, all 32 improved on quality measures compared to fee-for-service, but about a third of those dropped out of the program. The next slide I stole from Harold Miller, who is a national consultant and CEO who does work on payment reform, and he had a little bit more of a granular slant on how ACOs are doing in general. He said in the large component of the 343 ACOs that have signed up, and again, this is Medicare, only five to date have taken on the downside risk, which again is the more significant side of the risk menu that's offered. Of the 109 that are participating in the first track that started in 2012, 57 did not achieve savings, 25 did achieve savings, but not enough to receive payments of shared savings, and 27 did receive shared savings payments. I think just I was asked to kind of do again a high level, and I could spend the rest of the weekend here talking about examples in payment reform, so this is by no means any sort of exhaustive lifts. I just picked a few that I thought the community might find that were interesting. I think if you're talking about payment reform, CalPERS in California has an excellent track record, and there are two different programs that I would want to mention. According to CalPERS, they believe they have the oldest ACO and largest in process in the United States, and they feel like they have 4 or 5 years of track record in terms of an approach. In California, they partnered with Blue Cross of California, Hill Physicians Group, and Hospital System and PERS. They concentrated a great deal on the activities from 2010 to the current year, and they are able to report savings of $95 million at this point on this program, with a significant improvement in quality in several areas. The kinds of things they point to in terms of those improvements were really centered around reduction of what they considered unnecessary variation on hospital procedures, and also a reduction in length of stay. They've also done a lot of work, which I'm sure many of you have heard about, on elective hip and knee replacements, where the variation in California was enormous on these procedures. They bundled those payments. They actually allowed, after the analysis, they basically set a price for those procedures with quality outcome requirements, and employees and retirees could still purchase up, but they basically agreed on a set fixed price for those services, and they have seen some impressive results in that arena too. One that I think is getting a lot of national attention, and I think is might be of interest to this group, they have a very comprehensive website. I'm sure Janine is also very familiar with it, is the Arkansas Payment Initiative. And again, just some of the elements that are unique. It was started by the Medicaid Department within the state of Arkansas. It engaged other payers in the community for this effort. They were very interested in promoting evidence-based care along with the payment reforms, so they actually have, I think they're up to 14 conditions where they've defined clinical pathways. They've actually created toolkits. After the analysis, again, they've developed a target price for those procedures, and they also, to the earlier conversation about attribution, have a specific way in which providers are and are attributed in terms of the way that patients are also attributed back to the providers, and they have a name for it, which I can't recall right off the top of my head, but they are basically, providers are able to share in the savings, but if they also miss their targets on the quality or the ultimate price for that episode of care comes in higher than that target, there are situations in which dollars are actually returned to the payers for that situation. So it's getting a lot of attention. They hope to continue to expand that list from 14 to many more. And again, I have reference material on that if you'd like. I'm not going to talk much more about the patient-centered medical home initiatives because I think, again, most of you are familiar with them. But I do think there's a lot of discussion about PMPMs and different levels for primary care. I just happened to be spending some time this last week with a variety of primary care physicians who are extremely concerned about what happens when all the supplemental or grant funding goes away, and how in the world will they be able to continue to pay for services on the other side of the equation for all that's required to deliver excellent primary care kinds of homes. So I think that's an issue both regionally and nationally. There's also a huge initiative on the bundle payment for care improvement, which is part of the Affordable Care Act and is being run out of the CMMI Innovation Center for CMS, focused really around hospital care, post-acute care. It's another large demonstration project that I think will really be interesting to watch over time. So I'm going to shift, if I can, to the notion of sort of another approach, and I apologize that this is fuzzy, but one of the things that I was asked to address is how are some of us looking at regional payment reform differently? And I know this is a busy slide, but I think the basic overview would be, again, organizations like QCOR committed to the notion that all stakeholders should be involved in this process. And so the idea is if you bring patients and consumers to the table, if you bring payers, policymakers, purchasers, and actual providers of the care to the table, there's an opportunity to establish trust, to review the data together, to look at the community as a whole, as opposed to individuals, and to create the building blocks for payment reform. We also believe it's important that all payers engage in this, and Oregon has a great track record of collaboration around many, many things. This is certainly another opportunity, we think, and part of the reason is, from a provider perspective, if you've got 12 different payment reform experiments going on in your office, it's very difficult to have a critical mass to make a difference and to provide both the clinical improvement and also the improvement on the cost side. I was just going to show you a couple of examples from in Maine, a lot of work around medical home payments, again, trying to channel a lot of the funding streams, but also trying to create this bottom-up notion of the building blocks of actually providing stakeholders with the cost of care across the state to be able to try to rebuild the information to really enhance the payment reform strategy for the future. Wisconsin has picked a bundle payment for total knee procedures, again, voluntarily with multiple payers. They were looking at variation from $17,000 to $55,000 for a total knee replacement, so they're hard at work on that again using this same premise. South Central Pennsylvania decided to use the Prometheus model, which was again this particular packaging in terms of conditions like hips and knees and coronary artery disease, again with a collaborative bottom-up kind of approach. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the California Pay for Performance Program, which is the Integrated Healthcare Association's version, and they claim the largest non-governmental incentive program for providers. They have 8 health plans that have participated in that collaborative, 10 million members that are served, and have really done quite remarkable work in terms of quality improvement and also distribution of shared savings. I'm sure that in terms of this committee's look at behavioral health in particular, and we are certainly looking at lots of different examples across the country, there's a tremendous amount of interest in behavioral health integration. There's a tremendous interest in trying to find the payment model that goes along with supporting that. A lot of people have talked about the ICSI model in terms of the Diamond Project, which isn't behavioral health integration per se, but was one of these efforts to engage the community in improvement in depression care, where basically care was reshaped, and then they tried to also address the payment side of it, which was with a flat rate that they have spent now many years trying to study the addition of those dollars. A number of other states have emulated that, and to Dr. Gluckman's earlier point, I think with some mixed results in terms of the literature, obviously improvement in care, but still concerned about what's the long-term sustainability and outcomes in terms of the quality side of that. And I'm going to switch a little bit to just activities that are happening here for us in Oregon. As I mentioned, we are very interested in the topic of payment reform. We see the opportunity for Quality Core to serve as a neutral convener as, in some of these discussions. And this rich database, again, that's a collaborative effort of 15 partners from across the state, gives us the data to provide help and assistance in communities and in the broader state to look at payment reform opportunities. So we have 3 examples of current activities that are happening in Oregon. One is in Lane County, where we are working with a group of providers, clinicians, behavioral health specialists, hospitals, health plans to, and this community is rather amazing, a current company included with the co-chair. They have been very interested in the clinical improvement on embedding behavioral health integration specialists. And now the challenge is, once the grant money, once the original startup funds are done, how to recreate the payment methodology to support that kind of activity, which actually does have improvements in health outcomes. So part of the work that we're doing is to try to help the community with the building blocks to recreate what is the formula that might work for the future, engaging all of the stakeholders stakeholders that we talked about and the major payers in the community in that discussion. We are doing a similar effort in Bend in Central Oregon with the IPA, with the hospital, with the payers in Central Oregon. Their topic of interest is osteoarthritis of the knee, also working on clinical improvement pathways at the same time that they're looking at some kind of bundled payment. The largest one by far, which is the one that is really just a group that is currently working on a number of other tasks, is a statewide perinatal committee that is working on a variety of quality improvement activities. One of those is a committee that's working on data and a data center and also working on payment reform for maternity across the state. So these are in their infancy. We are really working hard to bring the technical assistance and data necessary to assist these communities, and like everyone else, we're learning lots as we go along. And the last piece of the building block that I thought I would mention was just we are launching a total cost of care measure this year, which is a risk-adjusted measurement of primary care clinics' total cost of care. It's part of, we are one of five communities across the country that are doing this together. We're using common risk adjusters. We're working with all stakeholders to get this information ready for validation and review this fall with release next year. So we think it's a really fundamental, very important piece for the community going forward. And then very quickly, just to wrap up, in terms of observations, I would say, as I mentioned, there are literally too many models to count in payment reform. There are significant variations in strategy and design. I think there are very few examples where stakeholders have been fully engaged in the design process, but I think we're all getting better at that. We have done over 60 interviews across the state of Oregon. When we ask people what the number one barrier is, everyone says it's data. And the reason is that in order to do payment reform, you have to trust and you have to have the underpinnings to do that information. I think the other thing is the more we can help payers and leverage payers, including commercial and government payers, like Oregon has really shown the lead on, that would be a wonderful thing. And we also need to get a lot more providers at the table as well. I couldn't ask for more in terms of rigorous independent evaluation. There is so much activity, and all of us need the lessons learned. And then I believe all of you all know this, but this is not work for the faint of heart. When you have combinations of significant power and money and a lot at stake, it is a very long journey, and I appreciate being part of your committee's discussion this morning. Happy to answer any questions, but that wraps up my presentation.
Mylia, thank you. I feel like sort of the fire hose experience, trying to gasp for air. A wonderful amount of data and clearly a lot of work going on. So we'll open up for questions from the committee. I'm sure, Bob, there's a lot of stuff that you're very well aware of, and I'm sure you have some questions for Mylia.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's questions as much as comments. There's a couple of things I would just kind of highlight that Mylia mentioned. She was talking about the shared savings programs. And one thing that you can see is that providers have very little appetite for downside risk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about shared savings programs, they're only really interested in upside risk. What happens to some degree is that sometimes 1 year's experience versus the next year's experience may be regression to the mean. So we have experience with a community-based shared savings model in Bend, actually. And the first year we did that, there were very substantial savings to share, and the next year there were none. And so that's not because the provider community got worse. It's because mm-hmm. there's going to be some random variation and regression to the mean. And so that's going to be difficult for providers to adjust to, is where, you know, there may be some unevenness in the reimbursement mechanisms. The other thing is that you can pay the entity or community in one way, and then how is that provider actually reimbursed,
right,
and how are they incented to have accountability for both cost and quality? And that's not always so transparent, and I think that's a significant issue. One thing I did want to also highlight on is as you talked about bundled payments and CalPERS, there's going to be a tension between getting the price reductions that are achievable through bundled payments and some of the pressures to that are coming up with, you know, maybe some discussions about how do we define network adequacy?
Mm-hmm.
But you don't get savings without, one, channeling patients to providers who have a demonstrated record of quality and also where there's some rational pricing. And so then there is there the you know, there's pluses and minuses to that. How far should patients have to travel for services, as an example?
Right.
So and for which services? And so I just think there's a tension there that people need to be aware of as we go into these other parallel discussions. You know, then one thing that's unique to Oregon that we didn't really mention is we're the most fragmented commercial marketplace in the country when it comes to payers. We have 7 carriers with 91% of the market. So sometimes it's, you know, you've got California or, you know, Rhode Island. It's, you know, it's probably 80% one carrier. I did also kind of want to touch on bundled payments because we do have some experience. Our best experience is in joint replacement, where it's been in place for a couple of years. We have a pilot program on a pregnancy care package. And joint replacement through that, because utilization is already so good, in terms of the efficiency of the care, they were able to achieve an additional 3%. And when we looked at appropriateness of whether the services that were provided were appropriate, and the modeling that we collected patient-specific symptom surveys so that they described their symptoms and functional status before they had their surgery. And in the commercial marketplace for Providence, this is largely exclusively a Portland entity. This year we're expanding. But 86% of the patients had documented severe arthritis on a WOMAC scale, which is an extraordinarily large number. You know, not everybody, it shouldn't be 100%, because that might, you know, there could be patients who have moderate disease who really would benefit from a surgical procedure. So the idea flitting about there that somehow there's a large number of inappropriate cases in joint replacement is not something that we're seeing in the Portland market in our panel. So the savings is going to have to come from efficiency of care. And if somebody has much lower utilization, then I wonder, is it that their patient population is younger or in a lower risk, or are they just making people suffer longer before they can get their surgery? You know, I don't know the answer to that yet. So I think those were the highlights. It's a complicated world, and I think you kind of articulated that. And I think that we're on the early stages of a journey. But on the shared savings model and methodology, there's going to be variation from year to year. And I also have some caution about how many different people can we promise the savings to. Reminds me of the movie The Producers, where everybody gets a share of the profits, and the best way to make sure that is to win is to not have any profits to share, and that's not really the idea either. And because I think that most of the shared savings needs to go back to the patients.
Do you have a comment? We have somebody on the...
Sorry, this is Robin. I was going to jump in with some comments for a minute.
Great.
Thank you, Maria, for the presentation. That was quite a fire hose. And just more comments than questions. I know in our own experience in Central Oregon, I was resonating with your slide talking about the role of regional health improvement collaborative. And when you look at the work of the Central Oregon Health Council, which is managing right now, currently, just the Medicaid dollar, that is the goal of that entity, to be a regional collaborative that works with multiple payers once we start figuring out, you know, the one payer that we're trying to focus on right now, which is Medicaid. And that council has always encompassed the payer, the providers, the purchasers, the consumers, and all of them, mental health and public health as well, as a collaborative. And I think that's a very interesting model to look at right now locally that's working quite well and is being replicated very successfully in the Gorge. One of the collaborative projects that we're working on between the Gorge and the Health Council using our Transformation Fund dollars, thank you to the House and Senate members on the telephone for the Transformation Fund dollars, we've worked with the University of Colorado Denver to do a study of our integrated behavioral health project. We've been integrating behavioral health providers into primary care now for almost 4 years. And we've done that utilizing health and behavior code, paid for out of the primary care side of the traditional OHP bucket. And moving now into a global payment strategy, the University of Colorado will be looking at how that funding is improving, how that service is improving quality, and how then the quality and the healthcare improvements that we can see can then create the sustainability in a global payment methodology. So we're very much looking forward to seeing how that works for us. I don't know how many folks know that St. Charles and the Central Oregon IPA have gone at global risk for the CCO population in Central Oregon. So basically, the hospital shares all of the downside risk. The IPA does not have downside risk. They do have upside risk. So I appreciate the comments about, you're right, providers don't have quite the appetite for risk that we'd like them, downside risk that we'd like them to. But we've been on a global budget with the CCO since March 1st, and it is a very interesting journey, to say the least. So I think there will be some very interesting learnings for us out of that as well. I also wanted to echo what Maria said about evaluation. We don't expend enough money evaluating these payment models, especially within the CCOs, and then also looking at the specific projects like behavioral health consultants, things we've invested in heavily with federal child health. It is very difficult to get evaluation dollars at a time when you're trying to transform care and people work fun to transform care. And I don't know how we help communities, including ourselves, prioritize the need for evaluation, because if we're not looking at the impact of what we're doing, there's no way that we can scale and replicate it. Our partnership with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement has taught us very clearly that if you can't measure it, what good is it? And that's a rigor we're trying to apply to ourselves, but that means we need to try and make mandated focus funding on evaluation as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Other comment or questions from Ilea?
Since I sit on the representing the state on the Quality Corp board, I'm pretty familiar with their work over the years, and I think it is having been at some national meetings lately. Even the evaluation of the ACOs is controversial. I mean, there was some massive improvement in some of those systems, but they didn't hit the bar that the Fed set for them. So there is a lot of movement. And I think yesterday when I was in this conference in Princeton with...
if someone's talking, we can't hear them.
Sorry, this is Janine. I was just saying that the evaluation of the ACOs is a bit controversial if you talk to the ACO folks doing the work, that the feds had set certain bars, and if you're like right under the bar, then you failed to achieve their targets, then you were deemed not meeting their success. But there was a lot of movement amongst the CCOs, the ACOs, to really do some massive changes. I think there is some concern about how to really drive payment reform based on some of the national conversations where they're, how do you do that and really push for value and at the same time that you still have to maintain the fee-for-service system going on. And that was in this room of some of the major gurus of health policy where they're still wrestling with that and just starting to see a glimmer of it here and there with the advancements.
Luke, if you could comment just a little bit more about, are there states in which, because you commented around the need for sort of monitoring, oversight, infrastructure to track the variety of wonderful work occurring in a million different places, are there states that have created some sort of entity or assigned duties to a particular entity where they feel like they do have a handle on data retrieval as well as actually the monitoring and learning and collaborative functions out of the work?
Yeah, I think that the NRE, which is the Network for Regional Health Improvement Collaboratives, which is the map that I showed of the 30 organizations, I think part of what that group is trying to do is sort of be a clearinghouse and a connector. And there's a public website that is ever expanding. And Robert Wood Johnson also just gave that organization significant funding to create a regional resource network, which is trying to do exactly what you're talking about, which is to do a better job beyond the 30 communities of trying to network what's going on in some of these activities. So linking people who are doing payment reform, linking people who are doing primary care medical homes with specific tools and subsets of information. Those groups meet frequently with one another trying to share community experiences, but this would be an effort to try to coalesce a lot of that information. The evaluation side, I think, is still, I mean, there are lots of discussions about investing, and I think nationally there are lots of agencies that are looking at it, but I don't know if anybody else on the committee would say. I certainly haven't seen a consolidated body of work emerge on payment reform that I would say is an but I just haven't seen it developed yet on, you know, what are the last 5 years' learnings. I have seen individual authors and papers, but I haven't seen anything that looked like a very rigorous evaluation. For those of you on the phone, they can't see that people are not nodding their heads no, but I don't know if anybody else on the committee might have. I have certainly not seen it, but it's something that's needed, I think.
I think this week's New England Journal has a review of the impact of paper performance in the UK. Yeah. And it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
And Michael Chernow, I think, is just completing evaluation of the ACOs. He was at this meeting I was at yesterday, and some of that is going to be coming out here shortly. But, again, it's kind of depends on who had the dollars to do the evaluation. But there isn't, I think, the clearinghouse of bringing it all together and sharing will be very valuable.
Okay. Any additional comments from the phone?
This is Ruth. I have a question for Mylena. As you look at these different models that people are focusing on, how much of it would you say is focused on coordinating care through patient engagement versus coordinating care through, say, specialty engagement or engagement among specialists in primary care?
If I were talking about Oregon, I would say, and again would welcome others' thoughts, but I would say obviously a lot of attention has been focused on primary care as the building block of transformation, and yet we all know that the connections to specialty care is significant. What I hear most often from specialists in Oregon is an interest in being more involved but finding it difficult to get engaged in ways on some of these discussions. So, again, that's just some general feedback. I think when you get into some of the episodes, bundled payments, obviously cardiology, orthopedists, you know, some of those that have kind of risen to the top as opportunities, those are unique situations. I guess for me and for Quality Corps, I think the most powerful activity that we see is that the more engaged the specialists and primary care providers are together in the conversation with the other stakeholders, the better opportunity there is for meaningful change to kind of rebuild it again. And some of these sessions where we actually sit through these workshops and build through, you know, what does it look like and what are the different pieces and who are the personnel you're trying to pay and what are the real costs, and really to Dr. Gluckman's point, when you talk about where to move the resources back, the community conversation about where should those resources shift to, you know, and I just think that the power is really trying to engage all of the people. But, Ruth, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was kind of my sense, too. We seem to spend a lot of time in ACOs and CCOs looking at how we can get the patient through the system. We spend time with primary care docs talking about what they can do, but the specialty side, which also drives hospital cost, is kind of left out of the picture.
I would just kind of say, I don't think that's what our experience is at Providence, where we have this clinical transformation council that drives, you know, it's kind of the way we can drive innovation. And so most of those projects are actually specialty-based. The question that comes into play is does the funding become sustainable? So as an example, we implemented a palliative care program for patients with advanced solid tumors, and that requires resources for the palliative care specialists. So we as a health plan in our integrated delivery system may provide the funding and pay for that, but how do we spread that to other payers that may not necessarily do that? That's where payment reform can kind of come into play, but it actually does mean that some resources that have been going to pay for some services need to be lowered, okay, because if there's been mispricing. And that's something that's not necessarily so popular all the time. It's how you allocate the resources, because if the idea is that there isn't just more money, more money, more money. Now, if there's savings to be generated because the care becomes more efficient, higher quality, we avoid event rates, then there is the opportunity. But I will just come back to the fact, if I take a look at something like readmissions for heart failure, national averages in the Medicare population, low to mid-20s. At Providence, it was, I think, 16%. So you're already, you're already achieving performance that's better than would be achieved at another part of the country after an intervention. And so I just think people, we are fortunate. We do live in a part of the country that has, high quality and more appropriate utilization. But it means, and that's, I think, one of the challenges in the ACOs that didn't generate, the targets, is if they were performing well at baseline, it's harder to generate the target. If you're performing in an area where there's lots of opportunity and lots of low-hanging fruit, it's easier to hit your target. That's a temporary issue, because eventually when they get to more benchmark performance, how do we make this, sustainable? So I do think, Senator Mona Sanderson, you mentioned earlier about, payment reform at a community level. We still need to think, how does this filter down to individual providers? Because they do need to have a stable revenue stream to provide the services that that are required for people.
And if I may, I just to bridge the comments and the question, I think that's even in Oregon our challenge, where how do we share the learnings of the communities, which we're trying to do through a number of different ways. In the two communities where we were in, stakeholders didn't know who the third largest, fourth largest, and fifth largest payer was, and didn't know who to contact. That's some of the baseline challenges, much less, Robin, to your point, there's a lot of fabulous work going on to also, the Providence examples you mentioned, other examples. How do we kind of harness within the state, some of those pieces? And so one of the things we're thinking about is, should we think about convening on some regular basis people who are interested in sort of a ongoing collaboration around payment reform? From an educational and a resource perspective, is that something else that we might be able to add value? Because it seems like it's an ever-growing need. So.
Mm-hmm. Well said. And I think to Bob's point, sort of no good deed unpunished. When you really look at the payment distribution across the country, clearly those that are least efficient are receiving the largest amounts of funds. So even if you were able to balance that, that would represent a significant opportunity for more funding to certainly come into an environment that's already efficient. So that is, I'm sure, the battle in Washington, D.C., and our representatives are trying their best to try to carry that ball. Any other additional questions from the phone for Mylia before we take a break? Okay. Hearing none, thank you very much to Mylia. We will recess for 10 minutes and reconvene at 10 o'clock. I'm going to go ahead and reconvene the task force primary and behavioral health care reimbursement. So hopefully we've regained everybody back on the phone. We will, the remainder of the agenda, we have approximately 50 minutes or so. We'll try to finish up a tad early so folks can get going. We're going to do, we spend a little bit of a work session to walk through some what we've called payment reform principles. So we're going to have a discussion. So again, I'm going to ask the those on the phone to please make sure, first you identify yourself, and then as we walk through these, we would want as much comment as possible as we begin to refine these principles. So there, for everyone on the phone, there are going to be two documents we're going to be working from. The first, actually, is the that I just want to run through is the timeline. That's actually the second to last item. Just again to get a sense of the work that we have over the next few months with the legislative process beginning in the fall with full vigor. We want to make sure that we have some information and legislative concepts and language available to our legislators as they begin their work going forward toward the legislative session. So in respect to the timeline and how long it takes to make this process happen, our work over the next two meetings will be primarily to further define and clarify our principles, as well as begin to develop the concept language. As we hope to do so over the next couple of months, that we can begin to modify, review, edit, and get to a point where we have a series of sort of legislative language groupings around each of our principles, and then we will use the wisdom of our legislative colleagues to try to figure out how they want to approach payment reform in the next session and how that language could most be appropriately utilized. So the timeline, again, will be over the next several months, and because that's really the time where we can actually put input. Beyond that, the legislative process in full vigor makes it challenging to really introduce a whole lot of additional concepts. So we'll try to make sure we stick to that timeline. So any comment, particularly from the legislators on the phone and here in the room, with respect to the timeline to try to get these concepts seem appropriate?
Legislators shaking, right?
Yeah.
It's fine.
Okay. You good, Julie? From the phone, senators? Hopefully we still have them on the phone. Can you guys check in on the phone? To redial.
Yeah.
They might not be back yet.
Yeah, they're on extended break. Most of them were in Tahiti, I think. No, I'm kidding. Okay, we'll redial into the number to make sure we get them. So while we're doing that, what we'll do is let's start to walk through, at least those of us in the room, we can start this discussion. They're probably all wondering why we didn't call back in.
Welcome to AT&T's teleconference service. Please enter your access code, followed by the to join the conference as the host, press other, please. There are 1 participants on the call, including you. You are joining your conference as the host. For a menu of available commands, press star pound.
So we just dialed in and there's no one else on the call.
Yeah, just if you can send out a note to say we're back on.
Will do.
That'd be great. Great. Okay, if you guys don't mind walking through that first item. And I think particularly, Bob, going to want your comment on one of our first principles states that we will rely primarily on the coding and documentation system, again, speaking to the E&M codes, to determine the level of service payment for providers credentialed by an insurer to provide those services. In other words, long language to say that there is value in the E&M coding system as a way of representing the complexity of the patient visit. Not necessarily the patient. Obviously, you've pointed out the risk or the inherent problems within the patient. Are those, in fact, addressed during the visit? But again, the idea was to use that documentation as opposed to the type of provider that's actually receiving this, actually providing the services. So maybe you could comment, maybe we could clarify the language or the general intent was, you know, certainly, again, to get to using the coding and documentation system if, in fact, we're going to maintain fee-for-service for that component as the way of determining the level of payment as opposed to the provider providing the payment or service.
So, you know, the concern there, it does not have anything to do with outcomes. There's nothing in that first bullet that says anything about anything that you would tie to triple aim. So I would say if we wanted to get to a better place, that you know, that first bullet might apply to a base rate, which is a component of the, could be a component of the payment system, but it shouldn't be the payment system. I think that I think that the wording here that I find challenging is determine the level of service payment. You know, because that implies that there's always going to be a fee for service payment. So if you wanted to say something about determine the level of service payment when applicable, mm-hmm. and if you asked me as a payer, if I wanted to have a quality outcome affordability component to create differential payment, I would.
And again, I think that our attempt is to try to create a series of principles at which point the combination of those principles will get us to where we go. I think the intent of at least the wording was to say that the E&M coding system that currently exists in some way reflects the level of service and complexity of the visit in a fee-for-service system.
I think, Rick, when you tried to translate it, when you read this one, it doesn't seem to fit in as an aspirational where we want to go. But I think your point of it was like the services provided, irregardless of the type of provider, is what you were trying to get at. And I'm not sure that language gets there. But I'm not sure what the best language would be there. But I think there's a different principle that you were expressing than yeah. is that the words actually, when you read it, like you haven't looked at it for a month, and it just like, I was trying to remember what it even meant.
I think if you're asking me on principle, if the same service to an equivalent population is provided with an equivalent quality, affordability, and patient experience outcome, that the payment is the same regardless of the provider of the service. That's where I think that you know, that's where the equity piece comes.
Because I think that's the principle you're trying to capture here.
Right,
that's
exactly the principle. Right.
Not that you want to build everything off of the existing fee-for-service system
right.
necessarily forever.
Okay, so
so I think that the issue is relies primarily is where the because that may not be the case. I would love to have a system where we're not counting widgets. Mm-hmm.
We welcome those on the phone back. We apologize that we lost connection during the break. So thank you for coming back on. What we're doing is walking through a sort of little work session related to the payment reform principles and commenting on the first principle, which is really, as Bob more eloquently stated, really had to do with equity of payment across providers for the same service or the same level of complexity of the patient. Any comment from those on the phone related to the first principle, which is really, to be honest, the principle that was primarily addressed in House Bill 2902, which was really parity of payment for common services. So, and we'll reword to reflect probably a little bit better language with respect to that payment parity piece.
Yeah, I think this is on tape, so we probably can fix that up, because I don't think I can repeat that.
Yeah, I hope it was on tape, because that was eloquent. We don't get those statements very often, so we have to grab those. Moments of brilliance. Any comments from the phone?
I'm sorry, this is Robin. I just was able to get back on the line, and so I missed the eloquence and kind of the step for this. I understand that we're in the document about payment reform principles and the draft of that. What specifically are you looking for?
Well, mainly what we wanted to do is really kind of refine and clarify the principal statements as, before we at this stage of the game. So the idea was to develop a series of principles by which we could then begin to construct legislative language that would help to make those things happen. And what Bob eloquently said really was that for like services and a likely a similar complex patient, whether the service is rendered by a physician provider or a nurse practitioner provider or a PA provider, that the payment would be there would be payment equity. And that basically because we use an E&M system in the fee-for-service world, that's what the first bullet item was really reflecting, more that our current status in the fee-for-service world. But we're going to reword that to really direct that.
I think that there needs to be a clearer statement that, that differences in the patient population and the resources needed to care for a more complex patient population needs to be part of this.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't want that to get lost as really a vital goal.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the one thing, and this is Robin again, the one thing that I would add in, while I know it is not part of the scope of House Bill 2902 to look at providers other than physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants, I would hope that we could encourage future task forces, future legislative workers to look at other disciplines that provide care as well. We have a very robust integrated behavioral health system in our primary care clinic here in Central Oregon that relies primarily on psychologists, LPSWs, and LPCs, who, while they're not prescribers, do play an extremely important role in the continuum of behavioral health services in primary care. And some of the outcomes and results we've had from that work have significantly impacted how we structure our care. They've impacted how we're providing care within the CCO, and they're a core part of how we're caring for our community. So I hope that aspirationally, we can look just beyond those who can prescribe and look to those who are also an important part of the care team providing care, if that makes sense. So when we look at that expanded global payment, it's less about who's providing the care and more about the care that's being provided.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that kind of flows into that second bullet, because, I mean, I'm not sure that we're here to improve any particular provider's reimbursement per se, but the reason we want to support primary care providers is to get really support care being received in the optimal venue, which is the last principle, and to support the care teams to give them enhanced care coordination. So I'm just wondering if there's a way to nuance that, what Robin was just saying, into that second bullet in terms of enhancing the team, supporting teams of care and optimal venue.
Mm-hmm.
and getting care in the primary, you know, moving care to the right into primary care and behavioral health at the outpatient level and away from, you know, emergency rooms and inappropriate care places.
I think Robin's, her last comment related to not who is providing the care, but actually the care rendered and being the optimal care. Okay, so as far as improving reimbursement, the intention of that, again, was to try to direct more funding into those environments to care for the cadre of provider, or to make sure the cadre of providers necessary to deliver that care, it's that workforce is sustainable.
Yes, that works for me.
I support that. I do want to call the committee's attention to the fact that the proportion of premium that's being devoted to primary care is significantly higher in Oregon already. And I just think I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just think we have a thing coming down the road that a couple bullets down that says don't add total cost to the total cost of care. And so, you know, I think that's also important.
Absolutely. And certainly one could, you know, you can make all sorts of inferences that, you know, in fact, that those dollars spent in primary care in Oregon are affecting the total cost of care. So
we may need to be dealing with some of the other aspects that drive cost up in order to create that opportunity.
Okay, but we do see that it's important to have that improved reimbursement in those areas in order to provide that base care. As far as the third bullet point, was one of the initial principles was really to look at the nurse practitioner and physician assistant part of the workforce and that would support an expansion or an increase in availability of those types of providers in the primary care and behavioral health workforce.
Would you want to add sustaining as well as expanding? Because I think we heard from some of those first sessions of folks not being able to afford to maintain practice because of the payment.
Is there a reason why primary care physicians are excluded from that bullet?
We could be more equitable and put them in.
I think that we need to
support the expansion.
Because it's equally the same issue in family practice, internal medicine.
Of a primary care workforce.
Yeah.
And then the skill set of that primary care workforce needs to be matched to patient need.
Yeah. So it's almost a primary care.
Primary care and integration,
mental health integration.
Because one of the primary care and mental health workforce, because one of the things that we heard about from the physician community from the Psychiatric Association, the last meeting, was that they're concerned about whether there'd be a sufficient psychiatrist workforce in this state if they felt that there was, you know, no added reimbursement for taking care of a perceived more complex patient population. Now, the numbers are the numbers, and I think we need to get more robust on creating the transparency around the patient populations that people are taking care of. But I do think we need to recognize that there need to be rewards, resources. It's not rewards; it's really resources for taking care of the patients who are most complex.
Yep.
They are a handful to take care of, especially in the psychiatric world. Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be clearly the desire of that group. That's what they came out most strongly.
And that's missing
testimony
from these bullets.
Mm-hmm.
Is that there's anything about matching resources to the complexity of the patient population, so theoretically that would support the expansion of both the physician and other health professional workforce out, you know, nurse practitioners and PAs to meet the primary care needs.
Great. And I think that's certainly an additional bullet point that we need to have, and that you kind of you really talked about the sort of that risk adjustment aspect, but really resources to match the complexity of the population served. So So we'll add that as an additional principle.
Or does that go into the supports the optimal behavioral health delivery model?
Model, but really clarifying, but also I think that same thing goes across with primary care. Making sure that, you know, the resources match the complexity of the patient population. And I think that was really where, you know, I think that came across in your data for sure.
Well, and this is Robin again. I think it goes also to the point of the ideal primary care home is a team-based home concept, mm-hmm. The primary care medical home that's supported by a team of providers. And how that reimbursement is spread across the team is in large part determined by the principles of which that primary medical home is governed or, you know, who owns that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If we're broadening the language to go beyond the primary care provider and taking it all the way to the team, are we then being inclusive of the nurse care coordinator, the community health worker, the behavioral health consultant, and the entire team? That would be where I'd really like to see us go, because that's what's provocative. We can talk about the shortage of psychiatrists until we're blue in the face, and there's nothing that we're going to be able to do about that. We haven't been able to do about anything for more than 20 years. And it's not projected to get any better. What can get better, though, is helping people to practice at the top of their license and right-sizing how coding and reimbursement work so that we don't have psychiatrists doing things that a community health worker could do. Whenever I have a psychiatrist who's making care coordination calls, that's not a good use of their time. But they do it because they're the ones who are incentivized to do it. So if we can find a way to move these principles towards team-based care that allow people to practice in service of what the patient needs as opposed to what the code needs, that's really where I think we hit the sweet spot.
Very good. The next bullet point, talks to really what Robin was just talking about, the integration of primary care, behavioral health services, so we're going to incent that. The reason that the word bidirectional is in there is that there is clear opportunity, again, to Bob's earlier point around the complexity of the patients, really providing adequate primary care support to those with significant behavioral health need. And there is data in the state that clearly shows that that's not happening. And this is a population that's dying decades earlier than the rest of the population it has significant issues. So, again, we want to make sure we support not just integration of behavioral health into primary care environments, but also making sure that behavioral health environments have enough support on the primary care side.
So, Rick, one thing I would just kind of comment on, I support this completely, is that the purpose of this task force is to focus on reimbursement in the commercial marketplace, right?
Well, again, to look at the state's system, but primarily commercial marketplace.
Because the Medicaid population and the commercial populations are not the same. So I think that this is very important for a small segment of the commercial population. It's very important for a larger segment of the Medicaid population.
Correct.
And as we start to think about reform and CCOs and the different activities that are necessary, we should really be focused on what are the patient-centered needs within those communities where, the challenges of, low health literacy, behavioral health, chaotic lives, poor social support, the burden of poverty. It is different, and it's important for us to recognize that the solutions to the patient needs differ in the different markets.
Right, but I'd say the care model, to me, in the way I look at it, is the same.
Yeah.
The amount of resource necessary to support the care model will be different based on the population.
Agreed.
And how you distribute that.
Agreed.
But the construct really should be the same. So, again, it's just to reflect that. The next item, next principle really, again, went back to not adding dollars to the total cost of care, certainly its rate of growth. As we looked at your rate of growth slide, that is not a steady rate of growth. It appeared to be, increasing rate of growth.
Yeah, I think overall, the total premium increases have stabilized in the last couple of years, but we think that they're headwinds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certainly some headwinds. You know, that's a reflection of the economy and people not having disposable income, benefit change, you know, higher deductibles. But I agree with you. You know, so this assumes that we will achieve a sustainable rate of growth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think the whole intention is that whatever we do doesn't just simply add cost to the healthcare environment, but actually balances and tries to invest the dollars in a place where it's most effective. So, seem reasonable. Any comment on those items from the phone? Everybody okay so far?
So far, I have a process question.
Mm-hmm.
How late is the task force scheduled to go?
We're going to go another 25 minutes.
Oh, I had it only from 8 to 10 this morning.
No.
That was on my calendar. 8 to 10 was on my calendar,
oh,
too.
Oh, really?
It was 8 to 11.
Has there been an alert to expand it an extra hour a while ago?
I might have to leave a little early. Yeah, we're actually scheduled till 11. For those that have to drop off early or leave, that is how it is. But we are scheduled actually to go till 11. This was a little bit longer session because we weren't able to get the speakers at the last meeting date. So I apologize, Robin, but it is scheduled for a little bit longer. If you can hang in there, we'd greatly appreciate it. And we'll try to see if we can wrap up maybe a little bit earlier, but that's what we're currently scheduled for. Okay, the next item really, again, creating, it kind of went to either bundled payments for sets of evidence-based services not currently compensated. This the attempt of this principle was, again, to address really what Robin was talking about, the costs of care that are not typically reimbursed within a fee-for-service environment. So that care court, necessarily the care connection, the registry management, the triage, phone consultation, some of those things that can be done rather than a visit-based model, I think was to try to identify that there's a lot of cost to some of those cares.
Wondered if we wanted to use an alternative word, because in the bundled payment means a particular type of alternative payment mechanism. So, you know, you may want to do shared savings, you may want to do
case management fees.
I think the intent of the principle was broader than the specific.
Well, and I think it goes to really what Bob said before, just recognize the resource necessary for appropriate case management. So, and we can reword that. And as far as that process, what we'll do is we'll do a bunch of editing. We'll get the brilliant words and go through the process of editing and push it back out to the committee for additional comment. So we'll try to make this make sense. And we'll kind of also organize these items. They were sort of just a list as we were going through some of our discussion before. So we'll try to organize the wording as well in the sections. So the next piece was, again, we are recognizing what Malia said around the fact that we are in the need of moving from a fee-for-service system to some type of global budget or some type of different payment model that is not dependent on visit-based payment. Just recognizing that.
I don't know whether the previous one and this one could be, maybe I'm a lumper more, but
yeah.
They could probably be blended.
Mm-hmm. The next bullet item had to do with, speaking toward the optimal care delivery model. And that really is for both behavioral health and primary care, but really, that whatever the optimal model was and what providers were necessary to create that optimal model, which kind of goes to Robin's earlier comment related to all the other types of providers that are necessary to provide care in the behavioral health environment. Certainly, we wanted to make sure that whatever this is, it didn't thwart that or actually supported that environment. So I think it's kind of mom apple pie. And then the other piece was making sure that there were outcomes based payments or mechanisms with incentive for high quality performance, as well as addressing patient satisfaction. Now, those were some of the things that were tossed out earlier. I realize patient satisfaction is a challenging measurement, but nonetheless, I think it is significant. So, trying to figure out what are the outcomes that we're trying to get, both clinically and then also from a patient perspective as well.
If we're going to stick to triple aim, we also need to add affordability or shared saving. I don't think that's somewhere on the page. So I just want to make sure that we have incentives to promote high value care.
So incentives for creating
high quality performance, patient experience, patient satisfaction, and affordability.
Okay. Any other comments related to outcome-based mechanisms, payment mechanisms? So clearly the quality and incentives to make sure that we have include language related to that. The next item had to do with transparency. And again, I'd like to get comment. Should we, if in any type of effort, also include language related to the need for transparency within this work? So I'm kind of trying to, you know, some of it is challenging because it's contractual, certainly from a payment standpoint. I think that the need for transparency related to quality and outcomes, I think, is something that we've already established as being important. But some of the things that we talked about earlier really had to do with transparency. I don't know if you guys can think of better language or a way to convey that.
Well, really, you're talking about public reporting.
Public reporting or transparency across, for outcomes. Again, I think that the effort has been to try to be able to be more transparent with respect to the product. I know that payers, clearly, that's how you compete. So, trying to engage the consumer and understanding the care that they're receiving, I think, has been the concept.
I mean, Quality Corp has been doing a primary care sort of scorecard of primary care clinics quality measures currently. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we as a payer have various initiatives. The one you always want to be sure that you have enough sample size and you've got enough validity to say what are real differences versus non-statistically significant differences. And then have we built in so if I use the example of what the state of New York did when they first started creating outcomes, transparency around outcomes for coronary bypass surgery, it was really very important that the risk adjusters were in place, because otherwise you can get people shy away from high-risk patient populations where outcomes may not be quite as good. So, I'm always a little cautious about what you want to put in there in legislation.
Mm-hmm.
But providing, what does that look like when it's a legislative mandate in a way that's actually, that you can actually implement?
Mm-hmm.
So theory, great. Got to see what we actually ask for so that we don't create something that's so, that's either complex or has unintended consequences. But I'm all for the transparency piece. So, I have a quality dashboard that we have for our for patients, for providers. We're implementing a cost transparency tool that's coming out in the end of this year that has the opportunity to have quality metrics in there. I do want to be sure that they're valid enough to show real differences rather than mislabeling people.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are, states that have, really are farther ahead on transparency. If you look at Minnesota and their public sort of dashboard, really even around cost of care, even episode cost of care, down to provider levels.
So I think that we may need to have some education about what's out there and whether that can be fitted to this task force or his future work.
Yeah.
But I just think we want to be careful about what we mandate in legislation and how can this be implemented in a way that's done well.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really, really good point because I've seen a lot of transparency data around cardiac, ortho, all those other good things. There's not a lot of transparency around what happens in the space of behavioral health. And not only is there not a lot of transparency, there's not a lot of experience on behavioral health and primary care specifically. There is some good literature on that, and I know the folks at UC Denver have probably done some of the most forward-thinking work around payment reform in that arena. Might not be a bad idea to hear from some of their researchers around what they've been able to find and use, especially when it comes to outcome measures that are consistent with those needed in a primary care setting.
Which institution was that, Robin? I'm sorry.
University of Colorado Denver School of Medicine.
That's what I thought you said. Okay. I just want to make sure.
Yeah. They've done some really interesting work around quality and cost outcomes of behavioral health programs in primary care and the integration space of behavioral health and primary care. And it's model agnostic, so it doesn't really depend on what types of providers. It's the actual work. It's consistent with the work itself. And they've put out some good articles lately on that. Might not be a bad idea to have a presentation with them.
Good suggestion. Okay, very good. And absolutely, Bob, we need to be sensitive about all the issues there. I think we just wanted to call that out as something that is going to be necessary if we're going to try to institute reform. And I think that even some of the clinical data transparency that you demonstrated, even with the stint mm-hmm. data, actually influenced behavior. The again, supporting wellness and preventative care. I think that's been it's been included within primary care funding. But there's clearly want to make sure whatever this does is really has an emphasis around wellness and making sure that everyone's receiving appropriate preventative care. And I think that goes with both behavioral health and primary care. Payments. Last couple items on there, again, talking about patient engagement and responsibility, there was some discussion earlier around the importance of the patient being an active partner but really part of the team, so to speak, but influencing and engaging in their care. So we want to make sure that we don't develop something that's entirely not getting the perspective of those actually receiving the care. So we want to be respectful of that. There was a sense that wanted to encourage responsibility. There are tools. There are things that have shown good outcomes based on engagement. So we just want to recognize that. And the optimal venue, again, that was something that we talked about earlier, but that was to make sure that care was received in the most appropriate setting, and that may not be in a office. That it may be virtual, it may be home setting, it may be a different type, but we wanted to make sure the care was delivered where it needed to be delivered, not necessarily only where it would be paid for.
So I'll clarify and just say I'm not a healthcare expert. I don't have that background, and so my healthcare expertise has come from sitting on committees like this and from serving on the healthcare committee. I do want to as I look at this and I look at what your goals are for the task force, I have a process concern. And the process concern is that this does not match the scope of what we've been tasked to do. And when we passed this bill in 2013 and when we looked at this in 2011, the piece about parity, and particularly looking at the goals of the task force, is to make recommendations for payment structure for the reimbursement process. I understood that this was to be more of a functional, how do we get that done? This goes way outside of that scope, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but from a, what we bring back as a committee to the legislature, that needs to be addressed. This doesn't necessarily get us there. I understand the goals to maybe look at, do we transition from a fee-for-service system to something that's more, you know, global budget, or, but there needs to be a functional side of what we were tasked to do, and I just don't see that really reflected well in this document. This feels very aspirational to me, where legislators were told that our task force work when we passed the bill was that there be a functional element of, we want payment parity, now how do we actually go get that, and what does that look like from a structural component, which is what I understand the task force to do. So I have a little concerns that we're moving in a direction that doesn't necessarily meet the objective of what we were tasked to do. And I just want to make sure as we move forward, we meet that objective. These are good conversations, I think, to have. I don't know that they're within the scope of this bill. And
so let me just get, because I think there is some question about what is the ultimate outcome that we're supposed to have. Because I can tell you from a payer perspective that before the bill was passed, on the medical side of the benefits, that Providence already was paying physicians and nurse practitioners the same rate. And I do know that after the bill was passed on our behavioral health side, that that's already been implemented.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that piece of paying for the level of the service is already done. The question has to do is what does equity mean? And I think what you've been hearing is that if we stick to equity as and define it as the basis of the level of service that's provided, it doesn't really create an equitable situation. It actually is going to provide higher reimbursement for low acuity services. And that's not an ultimate goal. We have to find a way to get resources to patients who have more complexity, if we're going to get a more affordable healthcare system.
And as far as the scope, obviously the tasky parts of specific language related to removing the sunset or trying that, those are portions of what we are tasked to do. There are components within the engrossed bill that really deal with workforce, making sure it supports workforce, and actually looking at the payment system for primary care and behavioral health, and that's the reason for the broader context of looking at, is this an opportunity to generate ideas, potential legislation for the legislators to review concerning broader payment reform than specifically the parity, because when the bill went in, that's exactly what the task was. When it came out, there were some additional components, and so that's what we've been attempting to try to address, is how do we support the workforce, how do we create payment equity, and really look at at payment models for primary and behavioral health care in a broader context, because they added those portions as the bill went through. So that's kind of why we've been doing it. You're absolutely correct. We will do the tasky things, and I think our attempt was to say, okay, of all the stuff we want to do, then how do we start building those tasky sorts of elements into our further discussion. So we will clearly meet the specific objectives. The question is this an opportunity to introduce other legislative concepts and ideas? And I think our group decided that this was an opportunity, relatively short task force time frame, that we could generate some ideas and potential changes on a broader scale. So that was the attempt. So the last things in the closing minutes here, what I wanted, there were a couple things that came out of the earlier discussion that I wanted to bring out. One obviously was the issue around making sure that resources match the complexity of the population. The other piece had to do with infrastructure, and I'd love to have some input. Again, you're not trying to add bureaucracy to more than we already have to systems, but having attention, because the piece around, I think it was Mylea was talking about evaluation How do you look at, do the changes we make actually influence the outcomes, and how is that evaluated? Whose job is that? As well as, is there infrastructure necessary to make sure that payment reform is successful? Are those elements that we would want to address potentially? Or is there the assumption that that would just be assumed by existing structure? So that was one thing they brought up, is that the struggle to evaluate.
I don't know.
So, Gene, you probably work with that more than anybody else. So.
Well, I mean, there's a cost to that.
Right.
So, but, I mean, that doesn't mean there isn't entities doing some pieces of it at the moment. But as far as, you know, whether you'd want to mandate something, you might add cost to that. So you'd have to consider that and weigh that. Is whether that's something the legislature would want to pursue, but it is important to add an evaluation component, and we've tried to do that over the years when we've done policy changes, is to try to evaluate the policy so you can feed it back to the policymakers as to how it's working.
All right, and so that would be kind of just a natural, it was just something that came out before. I just want to make sure we have some sort of valuation mechanism, because if we make any changes, you really want to make sure that it doesn't just add cost.
This is Robin, and evaluation is something that's really high on our region's list of things to try and figure out how to do. I know the Transformation Center has a partnership with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I know St. Charles Health System has a partnership with them as well. And part of what they're very keen on is that it is intentional evaluation of what you're doing to see whether or not it's making a difference. It is very difficult when you are doing multiple interventions. And a primary care home is an ideal place to say there are multiple interventions, to pick and choose which one thing makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal of evaluation really has to get away from which one thing is making the difference and more towards looking at the whole, looking at the whole team concept, looking at what's going on within that home and seeing if the entire home is making a difference and what does that look like. I don't think we pay enough attention to that. And early on in the CCO days, I know that we put a lot of pressure on the Transformation Center to say, gee, can we get funds for it? Can we do this? And the answer back was, you know, gee, a lot of our funds are dedicated, and not a lot is that. You have to find other funds to do that with. And I don't think we do enough for that. And I don't think we require it or incentivize it in any meaningful way. As we're doing these types of alternative payment methods changes within the CCO. But the only way that we're going to be able to translate the efforts we do in the CCO into the commercial market is if we can prove value. And the only way we're going to be able to prove value is to evaluate what we've done. So I would like to see us really make that a strong recommendation, however we choose to do that.
That's it. Additional comment? And then the only other question really that came out of some of the work was that of geography and sort of the regional differences across the state. You'd mentioned the variation even just in the markets you serve around the types of practitioners, even the level of complexity of the patient population within those geographies and distribution. So I think we just have to be mindful that we have a state that is large geographically and, has urban centers and rural centers, and so we just need to make sure that, or rural areas, that we need to make sure that we're, understand there may be regional differences in the delivery system, but supports that. And I think that our psychiatry colleagues were very clear that there were underserved areas across the state with respect to subspecialty services, particularly in behavioral health. So I just want to make sure we somehow incorporate some sort of sensitivity around some of those regional challenges. I know Robin's talked a lot about the challenges they have even in Central Oregon, which is, she says, the most desirable place to live on the planet.
That's very true. That's very true. It's like just nicely warm here today and very sunny.
Great. Okay. Any additional comments? What we'll do is, again, take this back. We'll revise. Thank you. Then edit with all of the brilliant comments, and then bring that back for further discussion with the group. So any additional comments from those on the phone or here? Okay, our next meeting is scheduled currently for the 20th of June. It is from 8 to 10, not 8 to 11. We are not sure about the July meeting, again, because of conflicts on summer schedules, but we'll tentatively at this point, we're not sure we're going to be able to convene in July, but certainly in June our hope is to do that. So that's when our next meeting is. So hearing no further business, we'll go ahead and adjourn.